Who wants a hard life? I don't think any of us would. I don't think if any of us had to put up our hands to say, yeah, I want to have a really hard life, that anybody would actually want to have that. We really want to have an easy life, don't we? Generally, we want to have a life to be nice and easy for us. However, having a good struggle sometimes is really good, isn't it? Particularly when you can achieve something from that struggle. So, for instance, with the Olympics coming up, there's a lot of people who are really struggling and working hard with the goal of winning an Olympics. And if they win that medal, if they come first, second or third at the Olympics, they've got something to bring back, then all their struggling's been worthwhile, hasn't it? They were prepared to do the struggle, but it was for a good reason. It wasn't a hopeless cause, it was for a good cause. Now, sometimes we're going to think about that with our studies too. I know when I was going through uni, sometimes I thought uni was a bit of a struggle, but when I finally got through and I could graduate, I was like, oh, it's over. You know, the struggle was worth it. And I think very often our movies reflect that desire in us, that desire to have a struggle where everything turns out in the end. So very often there might be a struggle where some great injustice has been done, and then through a series of events, that injustice and a whole lot of struggling, that injustice is turned around. Or else maybe there's two people who love each other and they can't get together, and then finally through struggling and them sticking by each other through all hardships, they get together at the end. We like a good struggle. But some struggles aren't that good. Some struggles are actually for useless or for hopeless reasons. Reasons that are actually going nowhere. Last weekend I went to watch my brother play soccer and actually won 10-0. Now if you know anything about soccer, once you hit double figures, it's the game's, you know, it's not a particularly good game. In fact, I could only watch it for about 10 minutes because I just, as soon as I got the ball, they just ran up and scored. I sort of felt, sorry, I thought, why can't we just stop this game? Just stop the game, because it was painful for it to continue. What's another example? Oh, the other day, a couple of months ago, I did all this work on this file on the computer, and I saved this file and everything was great, and then yesterday I made another file and I didn't know, I called it the same name, and when I saved it, it saved out of the top of my old file, and all this hours and hours of work, and I can't even remember what I'd done on this job before, and it was gone. But still, you know, I spent half an hour searching around. But it was a useless struggle, wasn't it? Because it just wasn't going to turn up. Now, some people were actually glad that their struggles failed. So, with Adolf Hitler and the Nazi regime, right near the end of the Second World War in Europe, there. If you were in Berlin at that time, you had the Allies coming in on the west, you had the Russians coming across on the east, and the German forces, under Hitler's control, continued to fight. And it was a hopeless struggle. It was hopeless. And in the end, they just decimated millions of young men, destroyed their whole city, and in the end Hitler destroyed himself. Now, I want you to think, what is the most futile, hopeless, situational struggle that you could be involved in? You have to think of one. What is the most useless thing you could be involved in? Psalm 2 is actually about the most useless struggle that there's ever been. That's what Psalm 2 is about, the most useless struggle. Let me read it to you. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against his anointed one. Let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. It's a struggle against God. That's the most useless struggle that there is. The struggle to try to defeat God. The struggle to try to get rid of God out of your life, to remove God. The struggle of actually being hostile to God so that you'll do whatever you can to blot him out of the picture, to ignore his word, to rebel against whatever God has said. To try to reject the plans and purposes of God for your life, that's the most futile struggle that you can be involved in. And that's what this struggle is about. It addresses kings and rulers, but also talks about peoples. And you can see that that's where the psalm starts off in verse 1 and it finishes up in verse 10 saying, therefore, you kings, be wise. So this psalm is about the most futile struggle, the struggle of mankind, of humanity, in rebellion against God, thinking that they can get rid of God. So let's have a bit of a look at it now. Well, this struggle is something that I think we know of. We can see it in the big level. So if you remember when the Soviet Union was in its full power, they would persecute Christians. They would find Bibles and burn Bibles. They'd do anything they could. They would be enraged against God to get rid of any idea of God. The communist system was an atheistic system, and they would send around lecturers, going to the universities, gather all the Christians together and then speak against God. That's the raging of the nations, isn't it? It's interesting to see how this actually affects the scientific world. There's a cosmologist called Fred Hoyle. And when the Big Bang Theory was first discovered, which they discovered through scientific research, through looking at how the universe was expanding and the afterglow sort of background radiation of the universe, they postulated that it came about through this Big Bang. It had just started off in some dynamic way. Now, Fred Hoyle was a committed atheist, and he actually hated this theory, because this theory was saying that the universe started. This theory was saying that, you know, that having a belief in God and this Big Bang was actually quite a compatible type of thing. And so even though all the evidence was against him, he and his companions have struggled to disprove the Big Bang theory. Even though the evidence has been against it, and people actually haven't accepted his theory because he hasn't had good evidence for what he's doing. At this stage, he's produced nothing. He's struggled hard. He's raged against the scientific community to disprove it, because he just wants to get rid of anything at all that could possibly in any way suggest God was there. Now, sometimes you actually, you might know about this struggle when you go to talk to people about God. You know, when you go to talk to people about God, and you can almost feel like you're stepping into a fight. You know, when two people are fighting and you've got to try to pull them apart, it's not an easy thing, is it? But sometimes when we talk to people about God, now, by God's grace, there's actually a lot of people who are keen to talk about God and do want to know about him. But for many other people, there's a rage there, isn't there? There's a rage inside them that when you go to speak about God, bang, off they go. Oh, it's just there, you see, there's this tension. Now, actually, we were talking to some students the other day, and it was interesting to see how this raging of the nations is in our own university. We're talking about evolution, and a couple of the students were saying that they'd written essays for the evidence against evolution. This was up in the biology school or somewhere up there, and it was a proper essay, and those that had done it actually failed. The students that had done those essays had failed. And, okay, maybe if one student failed, I mean, all students fail essays from time to time, maybe they just didn't write their essays very well. But from what I could gather, they'd written essays in other subjects very well, so they knew how to write them. And there was a couple of them who had failed. Now, see, that's part of the hostility, isn't it? You can't even question this. Now, it's very interesting that here's a book by a man called Michael V. He's an atheist, from what I can gather. And he's written a book. It's called The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution, Darwin's Black Box. And it's a great book where an atheist actually goes through and just points out all the errors in evolution. Now, it's very interesting, isn't it? If a Christian writes an essay, bring up that evidence, he fails his essay. An atheist brings it up and people rave about it. Oh, he's an enlightened thinker. He's enlightened. When Christians are enlightened and say the same thing, we're narrow-minded and anti-scientific. When atheists say, oh, they're enlightened for thinking it. So that's part of the hostility in the world, isn't it? Part of hostility, where God's people also feel that tension of a world raging against God. Now, the heart of this struggle against God is people's absolute desire to get rid of God's rule. Why is it that people are angry against God? Why is it that people are fighting against God? It's because they don't want God's rule over their life. You see, God made you, and because he made you, he created you, and because he's created you, he owns you, and he rules what you do. And a lot of people find that really offensive, and so they'll fight against the authority of God, the authority of God to tell me what to do. Who's God to tell me what to do? And so we see here in these verses that, particularly in verse 2, we see that the rulers gathered together against the Lord and against his anointed one. People's rejection of God is particularly against God's rule over their life. And we see here, and we've got to explain this a little bit, that God rules us in two ways. Yes, it's God who rules, but he rules us through one he calls the anointed one. And the anointed one, as we see here, is the focus of how God rules the world. God rules the world through this person called the Anointed One. Now, who is the Anointed One? I've put a little table in your notes there, so please just have a little look at it. Basically, the word Anointed One just means the word Messiah. So we'll go across on the table and quickly sort this through. If you have a look on the left, you'll see the word Mashiach in Hebrew. And as you go across the table to the right, you'll see under the column transliterated, you've got the word Messiah, and then you've got the word translated, becomes the word anointed. And it's the same for the New Testament. In the New Testament, which was written in Greek, not Hebrew, you've got the word Christos in the Greek, then that's transliterated Christ, and translated anointed. Now, let's just explain that table. It's important because this is actually an important point now. It's actually going to help you to open up the Old Testament for you. Very important point, this one. Right. To transliterate something means not to translate it. Don't actually say what is the meaning of that word and I'll find an equivalent meaning. So say in Arabic, the word for woman is imra'a. Now, I could, if I was just to translate that, that would be I-M-R-A-H or something, imra'a. But I can translate it and say woman, and so you know what I'm talking about. So I can just turn, I could turn the Arabic letters into English letters and keep the same Arabic sound, and that's that's transliterating. To translate means to actually find the corresponding meaning word in another language. So you see here that in the Hebrew, that Hebrew word is pronounced Mashiach, and that becomes Messiah, which is sort of the same type of sound. That's how it's transliterated. But it's translated anointed. And in Greek, you see that Greek word is called Christos. That's transliterated Christ. And it's translated anointed. So both the word Messiah and Christ mean the same word. Now, why is it significant? It's significant because, unfortunately, our Bibles, none of them work consistently across both testaments. So in the Old Testament, they never transliterate it. They always translate it for you with the word anointed. Right? So whenever you read the Old Testament, you'll hardly ever, you might find one or two references in Daniel to the Messiah, but apart from that, it's always the anointed. The anointed, about 200 references to the anointed. You come into the New Testament, and they never translate it. They may once or twice in the book of Acts. The rest of the time, they transliterate it. Now, I say that because when we're reading about the anointed here, we're reading about the Messiah. Okay? We're reading about God's Messiah. And in fact, all the way through the Old Testament, there's loads and loads of references to God's Messiah. Now, that was a little bit of hard work to do that. But believe me, that'll help your reading because sometimes when we think about the Messiah, we think, oh, just the New Testament. And there's maybe one or two little prophecies in the Old Testament about the Messiah. But the Messiah is all the way through the Old Testament. Get a concordance, look up the word anointed, and there's a couple of hundred of them. In fact, King David was the anointed. King David was the Messiah. And when King David had the opportunity to kill King Saul, he said, I will not raise my hand against the Lord's Messiah. That's in verse 1 Samuel chapter 26, verses 9 to 11. Now, a little bit of detail there, but you need to know it. So remember, whenever you read the anointed, and the word anointed comes all the way through the Psalms too, you'll see that the word Messiah is all the way through the Bible. It's not just in the New Testament. Anyway, the Messiah, the anointed, is God's ruler. And this Messiah is the particular focus of people's rebellion against God. You can see it there. That they don't just rebel against God, but they rebel against His anointed one. They rebel against God's Messiah. And so the Messiah is how we see people really rejecting God nowadays. How they treat the Messiah is how they're treating God. Now, why is it that this is a hopeful struggle? Maybe there's some hope for this. Maybe you can rebel against God and everything's going to be okay. Why is it that this psalm puts it forward as the most hopeless thing you can be doing? To be rebelling against God is the most futile thing you can do. Well, have a look in verse 4 to 6. The Lord enthroned in heaven laughs. So the one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. So the first reason why it's a hopeless struggle to fight against God is because of who God is. God is the great king. The great king, he just doesn't crawl around on the earth like you. He's actually the King of heaven. And he just doesn't live in heaven. He's actually the one enthroned in heaven. So the Lord who rules from heaven is this king that you're against. Now, during the conference, we did some reading from Isaiah. And I'm just going to quickly read this out again. For those who went along and read it once, it's not going to hurt you. I'll just read it for you. It's from Isaiah 40 from verse 12. Just listen to who this God is. And if you're fighting against God, just listen that this is the God that you're opposed to. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or with the breadth of his hand marked off the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket, or weighed the mountains on a scale, or the hills in a balance? Who has understood the mind of the Lord, or instructed him as his counsellor? To whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him, and who taught him the right way? Or who has taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. Before him all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless and as less than nothing. To whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? And down a bit further. He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. You see, that's who God is. That's the great God that, if you want to set yourself up against God, that's who you're setting yourself up against. The gods before whom you're like a grasshopper. All the nations of the world are like dust. Imagine getting all of Australia and just saying that's just like dust on God's scales. Imagine getting all the powerful nations of the world, like NATO or the US military, all of that huge military machine with all their computer-controlled systems and smart bombs and all that, and just realising that before God, if they were to fight God, that'd just be a useless struggle. It wouldn't even be a struggle at all. They'd just lose. All of the nuclear weapons would just lose against God. Or maybe all the uni professors, all the people with education who like to oppose themselves against God, the intellectuals. Do you think that they can beat God? What does it say here? God consulted nobody when he made the earth. God didn't have to look up anybody else. God didn't have to ask for any advice from anybody else. No one's going to defeat God through their own intelligence or their own strivings against God. Has anyone here seen the movie Ghostbusters? Most people seen it. Very interesting film. Actually, Ghostbusters is one of the evidences, I think, for why TV ratings don't work. You know, you give different gradings, you know, R-rated for something really bad and G for really good. I think Ghostbusters was G. It's actually one of those sinful films I'd ever seen. So you can't trust ratings, because in Ghostbusters there's this one scene where there are they're driving in their car and they're having a talk about all these ghosts that are coming along, because the Ghostbusters have had loads and loads of business, and they're wondering, why is there so much business? And there's this one point in the movie where I've forgotten the bloke's name now, but they're in that ghostmobile and whatever it's called, and he turns to the other bloke and he says, man, we've got a lot of business. And he says, yeah, you know what it is. And then he quotes part of the book of Revelation. He quotes it incorrectly, but he says the dead are beginning to rise. That's why we've got so much work, because the dead are rising. It's judgment day. And you see, the Ghostbusters, through their technology, stop judgment day. That's what happened. No, you go and look at it. The dead were rising, and through their technology, they overcame the supernatural threat. The threat against humanity of these gods coming in and invading and taking over. The Ghostbusters, through their technology, put it down. That was one of the most rebellious films I've ever seen. Stargate was also pretty bad. But I'll leave you to think that one for yourself. You see, our technology is not going to save us. You can't come up with a ray gun that's going to hold God, you know, and hold God and put him into a little trap or something. You're not going to be able to do that to God. God is more powerful than us. All the nations of the world are like grasshoppers before God. And it says here that God has appointed his Messiah to rule. Anyway, that's the first reason. If you want to fight against God, you think that you can rage against God and that you can ignore God and just go your own way, you need to realise that God is bigger than you. Not just a little bit bigger than you. You're like fine dust. You're nothing before God. Now, the second reason why it's useless to fight against God is that God has already made his intentions clear. Have a listen to this, verses 6 to 9. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord, he said to me. He said to me, you are my son. Today I've become your father. Ask of me and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will rule them with an iron scepter. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. You see, God has spoken and made his intentions known. That's why it's useless to struggle, because God's already said what he's going to do. Imagine if I said, I'll be home at 4 o'clock this afternoon. And you said, oh, no, Sam's not going to be there at 4 o'clock. Well, you know, God willing, I may not be. But if I've told you what I'm going to do, then that's what's going to happen, isn't it? That's just the way it goes. Now, God has told us that his Messiah is going to rule. God has told us, and he says in these words here, that that he will be the Messiah's father and the Messiah will be his son. God has already made clear, he's already made clear in his word, he's already revealed his plans and purposes to let us know that the Messiah is the way that God's going to rule. You may have often thought, now what's the key thing that the Bible's on about? What's that one message that goes right through the Bible? It's about the Messiah. It's about that God is setting up his Messiah to rule on the world. Now this promise comes from 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 to 16. I haven't got time to look at that now, but write it down, 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 to 16. If you're interested to look it up, you'll see there that to King David, one of the first of God's messiahs, God made a promise that he would be David's father. He said to King David, to you, David, and to your sons, I will be their father, and you will be my son. And I'm going to establish a kingdom that's going to be an eternal kingdom for your family. So God made this great promise to the messiahs that he would be their father, they would be his son, and that they would have this eternal kingdom. They would rule over God's kingdom. And you can see that that promise from 2 Samuel 7 is what's picked up here in Psalms. You are my son. Today I have become your father. You see here that it's this promise of God that makes certain what God is going to do in the future. And so you see, there's no use raging against God when you already know what he's going to do. If you know what someone's going to do, don't rage against it. God has made it clear that he's going to exalt Jesus, he's going to exalt his Messiah, we'll see it's Jesus in a minute, he's going to exalt the Messiah, and that's his plans and purposes. So if you're going to fight against that, you're fighting against what God has clearly made known. Now, Jesus was the heir of this promise. Jesus was was a descendant of King David, and Jesus inherited this promise. And we see in the New Testament that the things that happened in this psalm happened to Jesus. Have a look in Acts chapter 4. If you're not a quick flicker, don't worry. Acts chapter 4. There are actually a whole stack of verses which quote Psalm 2. I've written them at the back bottom of your page. You can have a look there. Okay, Acts chapter 4. Here we see that the apostles are being persecuted by the Jews, and they get together and they say this. I'll go from verse 23. Acts chapter 4, verse 23. On their release, Peter and John went back to their own people and reported that the chief priests and elders had said to them, and what they had said to them. When they heard this, they raised their voices together in prayer to God. Sovereign Lord, they said, you made the heaven and the earth and the sea and everything in them. You spoke by the Holy Spirit through the mouth of your servant, our father David. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against his anointed one. Indeed, Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city and conspired against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. They did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen. So you see there that Jesus was treated in the way that the Messiah was treated. That the nations conspired against him, the Jews and the Romans, all the Gentiles, they got together against the Lord's Messiah. You see, Jesus inherited this psalm. It just doesn't mean he inherited the power and the authority that comes from this psalm, but it also meant he inherited that struggle. And it was that struggle that led to them wanting to crucify him. But as we see, Jesus is actually the fulfillment of this psalm too. Not only did he inherit the struggle of this psalm when they crucified him, but he actually inherited the victory of this psalm. The promises that he would rule God's kingdom as with an iron scepter. Now what does that mean? An iron scepter, you know, like the queen has a scepter, an iron rod? Okay, it says here that the Messiah is going to rule with an iron scepter, smashing the nations like clay pots. Now imagine going down to Harris Scarf or somewhere, getting an iron rod and going into their China section. And saying, to say, I'm just practicing to be Jesus. Right? That's the picture of the Messiah. Now, how do we know that Jesus was the right Messiah? How do we know that God actually has exalted this one to be his place? I've got a few references for you here. Romans chapter 1, verses 3 to 4. I'll read them out. You don't look them up. And Acts 17, verse 31. Acts 17, 31. Just have a listen to this. Regarding his son, as to his human nature, was a descendant of David, and who through the Spirit of holiness was declared with power to be the Son of God by his resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ our Lord. You see, it was the resurrection of Jesus that showed that he was the true Son of God, that he was the true Son of the Father, that he was the true Messiah, that this was the Messiah in which all of God's promises were now going to be fulfilled. It was Jesus' resurrection which proved this for us and let us know that this was the one that God had raised up and exalted to this position. Okay, now, when we actually look at this, we actually learn something very important about Jesus. I take it that for many of us, we can think of Jesus as the pictures on our children's Bibles, you know, stroking sheep and having little children come up to him and being kind and gentle to people. And that is true. If you're God's person, if you've come to Jesus, then yes, he will shepherd you like that. But there's another aspect to Jesus, which I think very often as Christians we forget. This was driven home to me when my wife was at a party once and a lady who was a Jew was talking to her, and this Jewish lady said, Jesus did not fulfill the promises of the Old Testament. Well, you Christians talk about, oh, Jesus fulfills the promises. He didn't. And this is a great example of one of the promises of the Old Testament, that the Messiah is going to smash the nations with an iron scepter. Now, who is Jesus doing that? Look, Jesus came, he did some great things, the Jews will admit, he died on the cross, and he's gone, and Israel continued to have their enemies. In fact, their enemies came and destroyed their temple, and then Israel got scattered. So where was this deliverance of God's people? Now you might want to say, well, he defeated the devil, he defeated the real enemy. And that is true, he did do that. But, you know, what would you say to a Jew? Would you have to spiritualize it to say that was the real victory that he won? What do we say with these prophecies here? Do we say, well, Jesus actually isn't going to actually, you know, he actually doesn't hurt nations, he doesn't fight against nations. It's all just symbolic of him defeating the devil. I want us to learn something new about Jesus today, because I think many times we only know half of Jesus. Come across to Revelation, if you're a quick flicker. Revelation chapter 14. In Ephesians 4, Paul prays that we may grow in our understanding of the Son of God. Right, that's one of his desires for Christians, that we grow in our understanding of the Son of God. That means to know who Jesus is and what he's about. And Psalm 2 is what Jesus is about. All of Psalm 2, not just some of it. Have a look in Revelation 14. Now, this is a vision when Judgment Day comes. We might do Revelation next year or something, but at this stage, I'll just look at these last verses. From verse 18. Here's a picture of God's final judgment. It says, still another angel who had charge of the fire came from the altar and called in a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle. Take your sharp sickle and gather the cluster of grapes from the earth's vine, because the grapes are ripe. The angel swung his sickle on the earth, gathered its grapes, and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and the blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horses' bridles for a distance of 1,600 stadia, which is about 300 kilometres. You see, that's a picture of God's judgment, where they gather all the people who have been rebelling against God. Their time's come. They're gathered, they're put in a wine press, and then they're stomped on, And the blood comes out. Now, how high is the horse's stirrup? It's about that high. A horse? For 300 kilometres. Now, 300 kilometres, that you go from here, you go up to Launceston, and then you go across past Ulverston, where we had our camp, that's just over 300 kilometres. So imagine having a river that high of the blood. Now, come across to chapter 19, verse 11. Now, I just want you to think, who treads the winepress? Let me read you this. Then I saw, so Revelation 19 verse 11, I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse, whose rider is called Faithful and True. With justice he judges and makes war. His eyes are like blazing fire, and on his head are many crowns. He has a name written on him that no one knows but he himself. He is dressed in a robe dipped in blood, and his name is the Word of God. The armies of heaven were following him, riding on white horses, and dressed in fine linen, clean, white and clean. Out of his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations. He will rule them with an iron scepter. He treads the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God Almighty. This is the robe that is on his thigh, and the name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. You see, Jesus treads the winepress of God's judgment. So we learn a lot about Jesus in this psalm. Yes, Jesus is kind and fatherly and brotherly to those who love him. But to those who are against him, he will pick you up, put you into the winepress of God, and stomp you until your blood like... It's an outrageous picture, isn't it? And you see, it was understanding this that helps you to answer the Jew who says, oh, where is... Jesus didn't fulfill the prophecies. And you want to say, Jesus hasn't fulfilled those prophecies. Jesus hasn't fulfilled those prophecies yet. Jesus will fulfill those prophecies too. But he fulfills other prophecies before he fulfills that prophecy. And this is actually a third reason why you shouldn't rebel against God. And that is because of God's grace for you. That is, this Son of God, who is the one installed by the Most High God who made you and rules over everything, that Son, who has got the promises given to him that he will rule from God, that Son, who is going to judge all the world, is the Son who died for you. You want a reason to stop fighting against God? Because that Son shed his blood on the cross for you. That's a good reason not to rebel against this God, isn't it? Though you're hostile to God, though you turn against him and live your own way, though you're angry against God, his Son came and died for you on the cross. When Jesus died on the cross, he was actually taking that punishment that you deserve. He was actually making you, who are God's enemies, to be God's friends. Now, how can you ignore this? How can you ignore God's power? How can you ignore God's promise and God's grace? You can't. If you're fighting against God, then stop fighting. Look at these things. Have a look in verse 12, and we finish up here. Therefore, you kings, Psalm 2, it says, therefore, you kings, be wise, be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you be destroyed in your way, for his wrath can flare up in a moment. So that's the advice of this psalm. If you're at war against God, what should you do? Well, in view of who God is and what he's going to do, you should be wise. That's the first thing. Be wise and turn to God. What does he say there? Be warned. Be warned that if you continue down that path, it'll only lead to your judgment. And he says, serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Stop living life your own way. Stop being hostile to God. Turn around and serve God. Stop serving yourself. Turn instead to serve God. That's what the psalm says to do. And finally, it says, kiss the Son. That's what you need to do. If you want to be on the right side of God, you've got to come and kiss the Son. You've got to come and kiss Jesus. You've got to come up to him. Not a son who just comes up and says, how you going, Jesus? Nice to meet you. Shake his hand. You've actually got to come up on your hands and knees, crawling, and kiss his feet. humble yourself before Him. And you know what? Jesus will let you share in His inheritance if you do that. I'll read this out. You may like to look it up later on. In Revelation chapter 2, verse 26, we have this fantastic promise. Again, quoting from Psalm 2, Jesus says, Psalm 2, verse 26, "To him who overcomes and does my will to the end, I will give authority over to the nations. He will rule them with an iron scepter. He will dash them to pieces like pottery." Can you believe it? But Psalm 2 is your inheritance too if you're a Christian. Isn't that amazing? You see, Jesus is not a greedy ruler. Jesus isn't a Messiah who says, "All of this is for me, and I don't want you to have any part of God's rule over creation. You're just going to be my servants." He actually says, "If you come to me, you will share in my rule. You'll share in all the blessings and the promises that God has given to me." What a great thing it is to come to Jesus. It is really fantastic. Psalm 2 is a great psalm, isn't it? It really challenges us to stop rebelling against God and to turn back to His Messiah, to come and to do the wise thing, to serve God and to kiss His Son's feet. And when we do that, we're promised that all the blessings that we could possibly want will be given to us. As Psalm 2 says, "Blessed are all who take refuge in Him." Amen.